first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen and Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for inviting me to this program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So today we want to talk about the 104th year in which marks the Balfour Declaration in Palestine. And, this Balfour Declaration, as the Palestinians calls it, has set the stage for the creation of the Israeli entity and the occupation of Palestine. Before getting to the issues that are taking place in Palestine today, let's get back to 1917, Sayyid Murtaza. explain a little bit about the Balfour Declaration itself.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, this declaration actually prepared a base for occupation by imperial powers during First World War. And, you know, behind this was the Zionist, actually, powers that were present in European countries, specifically talking in Great Britain. We had that strong presence. And this declaration was actually made to prepare, I would like to add a terminology, and that terminology was actually introduced for the first time through this declaration. It was a national home. Mm-hmm. And this declaration was very much stating the fact that Jews and Jewish people actually needed a place for settlement.
That's right.
And this declaration, for the first time, introduced a terminology, a term for Jewish people in order to have a home in Middle East. So that national home was introduced through this declaration. Unfortunately, later, the same term was very much explained and described as a vague one, mm-hmm. because nobody knew about two parts of this declaration, national home. So because Jews were not very much the most bigger population in Palestine.
That's right.
So unfortunately, declaration was for the first time defined in a wrong way. And then based on that wrong definition, future developments were made.
So there was only Palestine at that time and there was no Israel, isn't it?
Of course, no.
As a result of this declaration, you know, a country by the name of Israel was established.
Well, actually, you know, there was a kind of strategic imperial, you know, purpose and goal behind creating such a declaration. And Great Britain, especially the Zionist powers inside Great Britain, actually were behind this declaration.
Oh.
So it was actually made for in order to benefit only Zionists and those who were actually following this political ideology. So there was no benefit to the Jewish people, in fact, and it was only forcing Jews to move to Palestine and create a man-made, actually, a system. And that was actually the Zionist regime. And we know there was no name as Israel land at that time. So a declaration was only a paper in the first place. Later on, based on the same wrong paper, there were more developments made.
Okay, Said Mohsen. Again, the role of Great Britain in establishing an illegitimate authority in the Middle East, okay, we could see, you know, the power of the Britons in the other lands too, you know. They had their own ambassadors and embassies in different parts, also in Iran. They were active by supporting the Babis, you know, who wanted to create a kind of fake mysticism or power or something like that in Iran too. They were confronted, of course, by Amir Kabir on that time in Iran. But all in all, I could say that these colonial power had their role in establishing new lands because of their own purposes in the Middle East. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the British government or the UK, we should bear in our minds that this is the cleverest government or the establishment in the whole world because of their hypocrisy, because of their, you know, having two face. And the main theme which they follow, through which they could rule over some parts of the world, including the Middle East and subcontinent. That theme, or we can say slogan, was divide and rule. Mm-hmm. So they try to divide the people of our place and then they rule over them. And that was the main reason of them having rulership over half of the world, we can say, or most of the countries. Now, this theme of divide and rule was applied on Palestinians as well. That's one side of the, that's one picture. We should look at the other side of a picture as well, that when we see the Holocaust happening and Hitler coming and killing all the Jews while saying that you will appraise me in future when you will know why I killed so many Jews, there was, we can say, like a harm or was a danger by the Jews to the existing, we can say, people or communities who were living in the Europe. Britain also never wanted to entertain Jews in their own country. you know, if Britain was at that time was thinking about the Jews and it wanted to give, you know, favor to the Jews, it should basically assign a specific land for the Jews.
That's right.
There is a big land over there. Okay. And if we can see that, they never did this. But rather what they did is they introduced this Balfour, we can say like
declaration.
Declaration in That's which right. the statement was, initially the statement was, if I can just read a couple of lines.
Okay.
It says, His Majesty government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing about Zionist regime.
Oh.
It's the establishment as a national home for the Jewish people. Now, the question is, since when we have a home on the basis or the grounds of the religions? Is UK a homeland for Christians, Muslims, Jews? What is it? We don't have anything. So why they did this? Obviously, it shows us that they want to divide and rule on the basis of the religions. And this is what they are pursuing. Until now, we can see what happened in the subcontinent, you know, the Qadiani. There is a religion which was made and supported by the British government. The Wahhabism, Abdul Wahhab, he came up and he established his own government in the Hijaz in the name of Ali Saud, the Saudi tribe from the Najd. So we can see these things happening in the world, which was done by the British government.
The British and the British.
So it says that it was a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavor to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in the Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The question is, when you made this declaration, today where are you? We can see the Zionist regime expanding their land.
Yes.
I would say these are the thugs who have occupied the land of Jews, Christians, and the Muslims in Palestine.
Yes, the Zionist, you mean.
The Zionist That's regime. Right. I'm talking about the Zionist regime.
Yes.
Now, when in this declaration they say that they will not harm like the rights that they have, then why they are sleeping now?
Yes.
Why they are supporting them now? Why, when they're occupying the Palestinian lands and they're taking the lands and the homes, destroying the homes of the Palestinians at today's world, why they're not saying anything? Why they're silent on such an object? So it is clearly understood that the British government or the UK always, whenever they make a declaration, especially for the countries other than them, there is a specific benefit for them, and obviously they want to rule the world. They want to become the master of the whole world, and that's what they're pursuing for.
And we know that since then so many catastrophes took place in Palestine. You know, mass killing of the people and children are taking place over there. And this year, 104 years have passed the Balfour Declaration, and still the Palestinians are suffering. Is it any way to get back to that declaration, Said Morteza, and delete it from history, and then Palestinians look after the rights for the lands or not?
Well, let's look at the other side of this declaration. One side, my brother mentioned, it was actually based on religious facts or religious elements. But actually what is happening on the ground these days is not based or according to any religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
So the political principles and ideologies is taking place all about this declaration. Long before, this declaration was described as a vague one. And these days, people are trying to provide a kind of close description of what was written there. Unfortunately, those lines that my brother just read have been misinterpreted from the first day.
That's right.
So from the political point of view, there are four reasons that so far have been calculated, and these reasons have been circulated even among mass medias. So the first one was that the Jews were actually massacred and prosecuted inside Europe. So they wanted to free these people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just an excuse for British government to provide a kind of a safe homeland for
or
the
asylum.
Jews. They were looking actually for a protection for them. Right. So the second was actually controlling a very strong African country, and it was actually Egypt. Mm-hmm. So they wanted actually to have a control over Egypt and Suez Canal. So they had the idea to control, to go and occupy Palestine in order to achieve that goal.
Okay.
The third reason was actually a kind of a strong lobby among British powerful figures and the Jews. When I say Jews, I don't mean actually the Jewish people. The Zionists, those who were actually the masterminds of creating such an ideology. And the third one actually was creating a government
this
as a
was
puppet
third one.
Yeah, that was the fourth. That was the third one.
Okay.
And the fourth one was actually creating a kind of puppet regime in the region in order to have the upper hand and control the countries in Middle East. So as you can see now, Palestine has been used by all superpower countries and is just, you know, creating some kind of problems for the neighboring countries around Palestine.
Right.
So we can see the political aspect was much more stronger than the religious. So I think that was a very strong reason. But if we go back and we plan to have something as a substitution or eradicate this declaration, so we have to go back and see the basics and the base for preparing such a declaration.
That's right.
Unfortunately, it happened around more than 104 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, most Middle East countries were some kind, you know, occupied by these imperial powers. And most Muslim countries were very much involved with their personal, you know, conflicts.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think we can go and create a kind of resistance to this declaration.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to go deeper and deeper into the layer of history and find some factors, influential factors that could have been actually used as a actually protection against issuing such a declaration.
That's all right.
By the points which brother just mentioned, 4 points.
Yes.
We can just take a result out of it that the Zionist regime are the servants of the British government.
This is so.
Who are working on the agenda of the, you know, British government in order to.
So who is Balfour? Alfred Balfour was a British ambassador, isn't
it?
Yes, he was. It was. It was
whereas
Britain,
whereas
right.
when they think like they have a they have a country for their own, like it is not the case. Basically, the America and the British is nowadays using them, and obviously they are the, you know, puppets.
Yeah, but the question is, why the international community is silent about, I mean, the crime of stealing Palestinian
land? Well, that's
land,
because of the system that we have in the world. For example, the capitalism is all over the world. And this system, obviously, it only talks about the investors and their benefit. The politicians who come, obviously, they also need some kind of, you know, investment.
That's right.
And they're also, we can say, like imprisoned under the system of the capitalism. Now, under the system, in the system of capitalism, we can see there were, you know, protests where it was 99% against 1%. What was that? All those things. So most of these investors and those who have the companies who are running the politicians with their own money, most of them are the Jews.
That's right.
And they're related to the Zionist regime.
Of course, there are still some Jews who criticize the Balfour Declaration, too.
Yeah,
you
but
know?
These Jews are not the Zionists.
Zionist ones. That's what we have to distinguish between the Jews.
We do
and
this.
The
that's
Zionism.
What I said. Like the Zionist regime is basically doing that. So the main issue is why the most of the politicians' countries
that's
we
right.
have the UNO, why they don't talk about it. It's because the finance is being provided by most of the Zionist regime, and obviously they are backing the governments. We can see clearly when there is a discussion in the parliament of, we can say, like the America or UK, they have these representatives over there
who
are representing.
Yes.
And obviously because
they held their own conference in the US.
It's because the system is corrupted.
Oh.
So until this system of, like this system is not being changed, until that time, obviously, they are in the power.
That's all right.
Let's look at the issue profoundly, and we will find some really understandable reasons that why Palestine has been named as the occupied land.
Mm-hmm.
We had these occupiers moving all the way from Europe to Middle East and occupying this holy land.
That's right.
So for one very simple reasons, nothing happens unless you have somebody in power in the system.
That's right.
So there was a very strong lobbying group inside the British government, and they were actually lobbying with other communities in the British government because they themselves were believing in the Zionist ideology.
That's right.
So these people, these strong figures in the British government, made this declaration to be identified in the first place, to be interpreted differently, and they put this declaration into practice by themselves.
That's right.
So they brought these Jews just to the Holy Land in order to give them a kind of settlement. Mm-hmm. But that was not actually the whole story. The bigger picture was a different one. They wanted to create a regime based on their own benefits.
Yes.
And they did this at the price of other nations.
That's right.
So they now the occupied land is, the Palestine is the only land that does not belong only to Jews.
Yes.
We have Christians, Muslims, and even other nations.
Yes.
So Zionist regime is the one that has been brought by these imperials at that time. So I don't think Israel is going to stay there for long.
That's right.
And their presence is not going to last long.
Inshallah, inshallah. Hope and the Palestine will be free one day, inshallah. And Palestine is for Palestinians. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen. And Said Murtaza for presence in the program Viewpoints, talking about Balfour Declaration. It was very kind of you. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Give me a fraction and call it solution. Don't give me a prison and call it a home. Give me borders and call it a state. Don't give me oppression and call
it. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
...31-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It was like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. It used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head sharings.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches, but at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor
next?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than it used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to their normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire-damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
a sudden, at least 30, 44-gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20-litre drums. The stuff in the 20-litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the work cover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I, I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I just got to watch him, and I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than three decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial, and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's woodblocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of thick sheets of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. The ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
A lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day, the limited hours or so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Tehran International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at a site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I want to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
www.parstoday.com/en
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.